Welcome back to the Dune Minute podcast, your place to dive episode by episode into HBO's new series, Dune Prophecy. I'm one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
We are back. It is Monday. We are just post-release of episode 2. And I don't know about you, man, but I got a lot to talk about on this one. Another good episode.
I have another 6 pages of notes this time, so...
We told ourselves, we made a promise to ourselves that we would try to keep it under 2 hours, significantly under 2 hours this time. So let's see how far we get.
Yeah. Before we do that, we have a lot of new people in our community. Blue Sky has been kind of going off, so just want to shout out all the people that have been engaging over there. It's been really cool to have, you know, a lot of really cool people show up and, you know, join us on this whole little journey and everything. So. Shout out to all y'all.
It's no secret that I'm not on social media too often, but I have poked around and engaged a little bit on Blue Sky, and it's been good. It's been a real good positive community over there. So yeah, I'm happy to be a part of it. So
there's a lot of very active Dune nerds on Blue Sky.
Yeah, there is.
It's pretty cool.
Well, cool. Well, let's dive into this. We are talking about episode 2. Titled Two Wolves.
I saw the title for the episode and I could only just like think of all of the "there are two wolves inside of you" meme.
Yeah.
And maybe that like was in my head for the first 5 minutes of just watching this episode. I was like, I can't think of anything else. I'm sorry. So then, you know, obviously, as we talked about last week, I've had to go back and rewatch it a couple times. And I think, you know, you probably watched it a time or two as well when you're taking all your notes and stuff for this.
Yeah, I usually my cadence is watch one for enjoyment, and then the second time is when I start taking notes, and I'll probably, you know, if I have time, I'll do a third just to solidify everything.
Yeah.
So this episode is directed by John Cameron, who has a whole list of credits to his name, directing and executive producing and everything. So you may know him from Severance. He directed 9 episodes of Severance.
Severance was such a fucking good show. Holy shit.
great show. Executive producer on Legion and an executive producer on Fargo, the TV series.
Yeah, so do you know what seasons or just all of them?
2014 through 2017, 30 episodes of Fargo. Yeah. So really, really strong director.
I know I've told you to watch Fargo. I don't know if you ever got around to it, but
I've seen enough to know that it's really good, but I've not watched all of it.
Yeah, you need to, you know, hurry up with that shit.
So, we seem to be in good hands with good directing hands anyways with this so far. So right from the start, the first thing of note is that we get a new intro.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, I should say we get an intro.
Yeah. Last week was was very like Denis Villeneuve Dune Part 1, Part 2 opening, whereas this is very much TV opening and everything.
Yeah. And it's very Game of Thrones, Westworld, like the classic new HBO style intro.
I had exactly like this feels like Westworld in my notes, because Game of Thrones, you at least had like the clock inspired, you know, moving parts and, you know, towers and cities being built up and everything. Like you had the Red Keep kind of show up in little pieces, whereas Westworld was very reminiscent of like whole objects just kind of with, I don't want to say B-roll shots, but B-roll shots like around them and stuff. You had the body in the frame, like rising and sinking out of the goo and everything. And it just looked really cool. So this felt pretty reminiscent of that, but we got a lot, of different bits of imagery throughout this whole thing, whether it's, you know, the hand gesture for truth saying, that pomegranate that we saw from the first episode at the engagement ceremony.
Yeah. Well, pause there for a second. Because I made a specific note about the pomegranate and the case that is on it.
The
case of the pomegranate, the gold thing. Yeah. Do you know what that looks like?
It looks like OG Shai Hulud.
Yeah. From Lynch's movie. It looks exactly like that. Like so too close to not be a callback to that movie.
And I it has to be intentional for it to look that way, right? Like there's no other. Yeah. So the original like drawings and interpretation of Shai-Hulud and everything with that, I thought it was really cool. Then we get more shots of, you know, different parts of the palace and everything. But then I loved that we got to see the hairy whales of Lankavale.
Yeah. I made a note. I was like, okay, so we have some kind of like animal. It's hard to make out that it is a whale, but, you know, laying on the ice that's being skinned. We had the Harkonnen from last episode talking about whale fur, all that stuff.
The so Baron,
you
put all that from last episode.
Yes. The Baron from last episode. So all that together, it's like, yeah, okay. These are definitely the Harkonnen whales.
Yeah. I definitely had to pause a couple times just to make sure.
Yep.
Seleucus Secundus being surrounded by a ring of DNA was a really cool bit of imagery that we had there as well. And then we saw something new that we hadn't seen for the first time throughout this episode, which was like this blue vial with a drop that was like hanging over an eyeball.
Yeah.
Spoilers, we're going to get to that here later on when we'll talk about this later. But my favorite bit of imagery throughout all of this was there was a section where we saw Rakella's, which then became Valia's, the ring of Mother Superior turn into a Gamja bar. And that was so fucking, like, I was like, there it is. It's like the Leo meme where he's pointing at the TV and stuff.
Yeah. So. Yeah. A lot of good stuff in the intro. Some bulls in there. We get the Atreides bull. Mm-hmm. We get, you know, images of the, looks like Shai-Hulud coming through the desert. Or at least some kind of big desert storm. And yeah, then it all kind of fades into a blue eye that we see. And it's really, really cool imagery.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever VFX team was in charge of doing this, they did a really good job on this intro and stuff. So
yeah,
shout out Agreed. To them.
So after the intro, we get our first scene, and that is a ship flying into Wallach 9. And out of the ship, a Sook doctor walks out.
Yeah.
And so our first glimpse into the Sook doctors of this period, doesn't look a whole lot has changed. They still have the tattoo on the forehead. And we come to find out, I don't think this character gets a name. Or no, they do get a name. The character's name is Sister Nazir.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting that a sister would then go on to become a Sook doctor as well.
Yeah.
But I guess the Sook school didn't really have any reason for them to not. And I guess the sisterhood, I mean, why wouldn't they want someone who's also trained in Sook medicine and everything?
Yeah. It's like you know, applying for law school. A lot of times when you want to get into a law school or any kind of like specialized thing like that, having a diverse background really helps you. Yeah. If you only study law all throughout school, then you may not be as good of a candidate. And that's someone who's like studied in like another specialized field going into law, you know?
Yeah.
So I get it. The actress who plays Sister Nazir is Karima McAdams. Mm-hmm. And you may know her. I don't think I've seen her in anything else, but just looking at the IMDb page, she was in Wheel of Time. The new Wheel of Time series, Deep State and Vikings were the top three that we see there. So I'm not sure if you've ever seen those shows, but she does a really good job here.
I hadn't seen any of them. So I've heard very mixed things on Wheel of Time where people either really love it or they really do not. So
right.
I haven't invested any time into that. Before we get too far away from it, though, I just wanted to recap the Sook School of Medicine and everything because we mentioned it very briefly in terms of the connection to Rakella last week. And we talked about the Sook school, obviously quite a bit on the Dune Minute when we were talking about, you know, our introduction to Wellington Yue. But the Sook Medical School is the medical school for this universe and in the Imperium, founded by Mahonda Sook in 88 BG, talked about it yesterday or last episode as well for our recap on episode one, but Mahonda Sook just happened to be the lover of Rakella. So Okay. Funny how it works out that way. Yes.
Close ties between the schools.
Yes. 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 Very much so. And my favorite bit of trivia that we also talked about in relation to the souk were that the diamond tattoo on their foreheads mm-hmm. was it down to the atom level precise, or was it?
Well, they cataloged it down to the molecular level or something. Yeah. So that they could be able to distinguish, you know, each tattoo is unique. So it becomes even a better way of identification than a fingerprint would be.
Yeah. So that was their way of legitimizing people who had actually successfully, you know, gone through souk training yeah. for medicine and everything. So I thought yeah. it was just really cool that we get that immediate imagery. And it's just like, if you know, you know.
So Sister Nazir is here to basically do an autopsy on Kasha. So we cut from the landing pad over to a medical room examination table where the body of Kasha is laid out. Tula is there to kind of oversee things. And we get Nazir trying to, you know, explain what happened and figure out what exactly happened to Kasha. She says it was internal, like combustion almost. That's basically what they say. And I believe the exact quote from the show is that there was some imbalance in the meridian network.
Yeah. An acute imbalance in the
meridian network, which is a thing that exists on Earth today. The meridian network, it's part of the like traditional Chinese medicine. They believe you have these lines throughout your body where your life force flows, your qi, and that is sometimes referred to as the meridian system or the meridian network. So given how the sisterhood and, you know, eventually the Bene Gesserit are so in tune with like the prana bindu and, you know, just manipulating your body on the atomic and molecular level, I think that's a strong tie to make. It's a really cool connection there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool to see them kind of go into their, especially in this case, you know, put medical terms into sisterhood terms. That way Tula has a complete and like full understanding of what happened to Kasha yeah. in this place.
Yeah, exactly. So the doc is asking if there have been any changes with Kasha, and Tula mentions that her dream, she had a nightmare dream.
She specifically asked if there were any physical changes or signs of distress. And man, if Kasha wasn't distressed last episode.
Right, right. And you just see a bunch of, you know, guilt and remorse coming from Tula because, you know, she says it out loud. You're like, I should have listened.
Yeah.
So she's shouldering some of the blame on this. And she gets a chance to escape if she's feeling uncomfortable, but she's, you know, like, nope, I'm staying here. I need answers.
Mm-hmm. And then we see more of those same motions that we see from UA mm-hmm. in part one, where he's, you know, putting his hands behind Paul's skull to feel around the back of his neck for, you know, how things are going in his body. Same thing is being done to Kasha's body here on the table to just try and gather more information.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's still a mystery right now as to exactly what happened. So
yep. Yeah, it is. We don't linger here too long, though. We cut right back to the library
mm-hmm.
where the sisters Emmeline, Jen, Theodosia, and Lila are studying and just kind of talking about all the crazy shit that's been going on.
One line in particular that really came out to me when I was watching was, I don't remember if it was Theodosia that said this, but, you know, if the Emperor's truthsayer had just been killed before a royal wedding, that's no coincidence. It's an assassination.
Yeah, Theodosia's definitely leaning hard into like the assassination theory
yeah.
here. They're all just, you know, they're all shook up about Kasha's death because, you know, they were close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure how close, but, you know, they were all at the school at the same time. So doubt that Kasha was some kind of mentor to them.
Yeah, we'll come to learn later this episode, too, that Kasha was incredibly looked up to.
Yeah.
And I believe she's not just a sister, but a reverend mother. So, at least referred to as a mother. So if she's that influential, obviously there's going to be reverberations throughout the entire sisterhood. So, but we know for sure that Tula is a reverend mother. Thalia is obviously Mother Supreme.
Mother Supreme. I think I might order one of those from Taco Bell later. Yeah. So we the camera pans up and Valya is watching over them as she loves to do on that perch
from her office.
From her office up there. And Tula comes up the stairs to give her an update on the autopsy. And really, the update is that there is no update. It's, you know, we don't really know anything. It's a preliminary scans, I guess, were, you know, inconclusive. And there's going to have to be more tests to be done. So there's not making much progress in the way of figuring out what the heck happened to Kasha.
Mm-hmm. Valya then says that, you know, she tells Tula, hey, by the way, I'm leaving for Seleucia Secundus like now, because guess what? Pruitt Richesi is also dead, burned alive as well. So something is definitely going on. Yeah. And she comes to believe that this is the burning truth that Raquella warned her of. So she obviously has taken a lot of Raquella's, you know, final moments as incredibly influential in guiding her, and she needs to figure out the solution to what's going on here. Tula offers to take care of things, but Thalia doesn't seem to believe that she's up to the task, simply because she doesn't trust Tula to convince Lila to undergo agony.
Yeah, and I, after like a rewatch or two, that part was like, okay, yeah, I think she has faith that she could run the school fine, but she knows that this getting Lila to, you know, agree to do the agony on her own is something that's going to be very hard for her. So that reticence came from not necessarily like all the administrative tasks. I think she has faith that she could do the administrative stuff, but just that one single thing, that one tough decision that she mentions is going to be, you know, especially hard for her.
But it's super important that they convince Lila to undergo the agony, because it's the only way. And we come to learn later on, but Lila is the great, great granddaughter of Raquella. And as we've talked about in previous episodes of the Dune Minute, you know, female memories across, you know, your entire genetic timeline are passed down from women to women. And the only way to unlock that is through the agony, which isn't fun. That's for sure. Yeah.
It's aptly named.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if the sisterhood made sure that they have a member of Raquella's family
always
kind of on hand, you know, for these kinds of things. Like maybe, and that's kind of like a standing rule. This is completely, you know, I'm theorizing here. Like, you know, super important people that do like crazy important things, they always make sure that their genetic line's accessible to them so they can go back and, you know, talk.
Well, I mean, it would stand to reason that they would always have one person from each of the great houses as well. Inez being, you know, of House Carino, and before that, technically a butler. So, because the Carinos were butlers that just took the name Carino after the Battle of Corrin. So,
yeah, exactly. So, after a little bit of back and forth, Tula's last words here are, her last sentiment is that she's worried that, not necessarily that Lila would not be ready for the agony, but that she would learn things that she's not supposed to learn.
Other secrets that Tula and Valya and Kasha had kept.
Yeah. So that's a heavy, heavy moment of foreshadowing that we'll talk about towards the end of the show.
Yeah.
Then we cut back down to the library, and Valya grabs Theodosia and asks her to join her on Seleucia Secundus.
It's not really an ask. It's more of a, hey, yeah, get in the car. We're going.
Yeah, fair. Theodosia like throws out this line that I think will probably come into some significance later. But she says, and you're aware of my circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea what that means right now, like what those circumstances might be, but that's just, you know, something we'll have to keep watching and figure out.
Yeah, we didn't get any Theodosia background or anything last week. We only really saw her when she was with all of the other girls doing their various trainings, whether it was, you know, Prana Bindu training, or if they were, you know, undergoing truthsayer training or what have you. We did see, though, that Theodosia was just like absolutely dominating in some of the hand-to-hand combat, the Weirding Way trainings and stuff.
She's definitely strong, and
she's a badass.
We get a little bit of I don't know if you'd call it backstory, but just a little bit more exposition on Theodosia when they're doing their vetting process. Last episode, and we come to find out that Theodosia is Valia's favorite. Out of the, you know, the new acolytes. So maybe there's some favoritism at play here when Valia asked her to come to the palace. Probably deserved, maybe, but, you know.
But also I feel like Valia would only take someone, like, especially given the circumstances, would only take someone that she, like, truly trusts to do their job and do it right in this kind of situation.
So, I think we're going to have a lot more about Theodosia as the series continues.
And then we go back to Seleucus Secundus.
And man, before we get into that too much, I gotta say, like, this is another episode of like whiplash back and forth between different places.
Not as aggressive this episode, but it still is like, y'all, we could have just done this like in larger chunks. Come on.
So we go into a big old room in the palace, and there is a viewing for Pruitt. Seems like kind of like a traditional funeral viewing.
I wouldn't really say it's a viewing since he's under.
No, sure.
It's a wake.
We'll call it closed casket.
closed silk tablecloth.
Yeah, right. And the first thing we see is Constantine just absolutely giving the eyes to the Richese daughter. Just like they are staring each other down, flirting without flirting or without verbally talking. So I guess more to come on that. And we learn that the emperor is not there, and the Duke Richese he's pissed about it. He sees that as a slight and an insult, and he's letting Natalia have it.
I hate to be that guy, but it's technically Richese.
Richese? I thought they
It's Richese.
Didn't they said Richese though? They didn't.
No.
Richese. Okay.
Richese. We also speaking of pronunciations, we get the pronunciation for the emperor's name, and it's not Javico, it's Havico.
Yeah.
So sorry about that for last week's episode. My bad. Hey, I'm going to correct myself here, dumbass.
We are all learning together, John.
Yeah. Havico isn't present, and he will join when he can. And Duke Richese's just response to that is just, how convenient.
Yeah.
Such a dick. I mean, granted, his son just died. Like, he's not the happiest guy in the world right now, but also, you know, the emperor's
got
shit.
And he's
to
throwing
do.
Shade left and right here. He's not happy. He thinks something else is going on. He's, you know, getting really, really paranoid about everything. So, yeah, I mean, I get it.
Yep. He doesn't believe that his son's quote unquote toy did this. And Empress Natalia immediately just reiterates in the first place that the boy shouldn't have had the thinking machine. And the Richeses know the risks involved with having any thinking machine. So she's just like, I'm not playing your fucking games here. Why does this kid have a thinking machine?
So I guess that, but on that real quick, I guess that's the kind of the explanation that's being circled around right now, or spread around, is that, it must have been his toy, you know, rebelled or whatever against him and burnt him up. So, I don't know if, I mean, I think Natalia, like, she believes it right now. She believes that because she hasn't heard anything about Desmond yet, but, it's a very convenient way of just, you know, explaining away the situation.
It's an easy, the thinking machine is the easiest scapegoat because you got to remember, we're not very far off from the end of the Butlerian Jihad here. So it, everything is still very fresh in memory.
Yep.
But yeah, then Duke Richesi just turns and immediately like threatens Natalia with the fact that he still owns the fleet of fighters above orbit of Seleucia Secunda's. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just going to nuke the place if he doesn't get what he wants.
Yeah. And that's
maybe
that's
quite kind of literally.
And that's kind of a threat that we're going to see held over the Emperor throughout the remainder of this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Richesi doesn't want to play it. Doesn't want to mess around.
Then the last scene we get here at this this wake is some more eyes between Constantine and the Richesi daughter. So, yeah, just, you know, I bookend this scene with some sexy eyes back and forth.
And then we go to the least sexy place, an empty room with a table.
I think this is the hollow table that we saw in the first episode. Yeah. So depending on what little card you put in, it could be a very sexy room.
Maybe. But Havoco and Desmond are in this, what I just called it an office in my notes, but they're in this office at the hologram table, and Desmond is doing a little bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge to Havoco about how he definitely, or about how Havoco definitely didn't tell him to kill the kid. And Havoco's like, no, I didn't say that I need
you to actually kill the kid. Do that.
Yeah. And Desmond's like, right. Yeah, sure, bud.
Miscommunications.
Havoco says that it was a private concern. I did not tell you to kill that boy. And Desmond's like, yeah, but you wanted me to. So that's what I did. And I did it for you, and I'll do it again. Havoco doesn't want any more of this, so he has Desmond arrested and brought to a suspensor cell. Havoco wants to keep it quiet, and Kieran Atreides says that he'll see to it personally. And then we just immediately go to the suspensor cell and see, you know, Desmond elevated into the air, and, you know, he's bound by the wrists at his waist and everything. Mm-hmm. And he's just kind of floating in the air, and the lights are shut off behind him.
Yep.
Thank you, Holtzman.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, you know, we see a lot of the stuff that is, you know, attributed to Holtzman, mm-hmm. a lot of the technologies, but we've yet to hear the name. We've yet to, you know, be introduced to this character or anything. So I don't think we're going to get it in this series.
No, I think we're beyond any mention of Holtzman, which is really sad, but thankfully, the Dune Minute will be having summer school in January, and we're going to be dedicating an entire long form episode just to Holtzman and everything that he did.
Yeah.
So keep an eye out on your feeds for that. That'll be coming up start of the new year. So,
yeah. Yeah. So we cut quickly back over to Wallach 9, and Tula is still talking to Lila, kind of subtly convincing her to make the decision to undergo the agony. Mm-hmm. And she explains that, you know, Raquella's vision right before she died, and how it relates to everything that's going on right now with the burnings. And, you know, there's some new threat that is cropped up. And in this conversation is when we get the I'm going to call it a bombshell, because especially is for Lila, that she is the great, great granddaughter of Raquella.
Yep.
You know, at the beginning of this conversation that we hear, one of the first things that they talk about is why they do not tell the members of the sisterhood, you know, who their lineage is.
Yeah.
You know, it's just to make sure that their allegiances are not to houses or anything like that. Their allegiances are to the sisterhood, you know, it could distract them or color their thinking in some kind of way.
And that's something that we see continued practice 10,000 years in the future when Jessica is born, the daughter of Vladimir Harkonnen is taken immediately by the sisterhood.
Spoilers.
Yeah. Spoilers for a movie that came out earlier this year that you probably would have watched if you're watching this show at this point.
Fair enough.
Or definitely listening to this podcast.
Yeah. Lila's freaked out. She really does not feel like she's ready to undergo this. You know, she states that it takes a lot of training and time, and she's too young and all these things. And Tula is doing her best to assuage these fears and just, you know, really convince her that she is ready.
She says that she has a unique and natural aptitude that leaves her in a position to try and conquer the agony, but it ultimately must be her choice.
Yeah. And, you know, the more that I hear from, like, these conversations from Tula and Lila, the more that I'm kind of on Jen's side about this whole thing. Like, they really are, like, manipulating Lila. And I believe that Tula's trust in her is genuine.
Yeah.
But there's no way that she could be ready for this. And they're really pushing her to do this because it's an immediate need. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, and we'll definitely get more into Jen's feelings here.
Yeah, there's a whole scene about that later.
Yeah. But even in episode one, Jen was kind of it was interesting that she was accepted as an acolyte, but she's still kind of a sisterhood naysayer.
Yeah.
She's an interesting character. I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with her.
Yeah, me too. So Whiplash, back to Seleucia Secundus, and we get a good reminder that, after all, this is an HBO show.
Yes, it is. So there must be a sex scene.
Yep. And, you know, I got to say, I think this is the first nudity in all of Dune.
Nope.
No?
Nope. We had it last week.
Did we?
Yep.
When?
Kieran in the nightclub.
Does he hang dong there?
We don't see him hanging dong. This is HBO. Dong doesn't get hung unless it's Game of Thrones. Let's be real.
Yeah, but
actually, not true, because dong's also hung in Rome. But
yeah, plenty of dong in Rome. There was someone with like a very sheer mesh shirt last episode.
Yeah.
At the bar. Okay, so yeah. That's technically, that was, I guess, the first nudity in Dune. But this is the first, like,
true nudity. This is the first full-body nudity, yes.
Yeah. So, way to go, HBO. We did it. We got nudity in Dune.
Yay. The beef swelling continues.
Yeah, right. So, we get the sex scene between Constantine and Lady Shannon Richese. And Lady Shannon is played by Tessa Bonham Jones. And I was looking through the IMDb page. I mean, she's got a extensive history of stuff. I mean, Dune is obviously the latest that she's been in, but Crapopolis is Crapopolis is a animated TV series where she plays a narrator. And you know, just looking back through, she was in the Wonder Woman 1984 that was released in 2020. And a couple of other just, you know, episodes here and there. So this seems like to be the first, you know, really big role that she's had.
Good for her.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, we're in
after the sex scenes, we get some space cocaine again. Get some drug use, and I mean, they're really just prying each other for information. It feels like.
Well, they're not prying each other for. Constantine thinks he's prying for information. He's not getting any. But yeah. Man, does Constantine have loose lips, and he's just letting Shannon know everything here.
Yeah.
And yeah, she's she's using sex to fish information from him. And, you know, she comes to find that Habako does have the prisoner that they think, you know, or that they know killed the son, and that he's from Arrakis.
Well, I don't think they know. They just know that he has a prisoner from Arrakis in custody, or a soldier from Arrakis in custody.
Yeah.
I think that's something that the Duke kind of puts together on the back end. But yeah, to that point, he is correct.
Yeah. Shannon says something in response to a question from Constantine. He asks, you know, will the Duke use the fleet to seize the throne now that he can't marry into it? And Shannon's response is, power is meaningless. The real power is with whoever controls the desert planet. Great houses, mm-hmm. the Spacing Guild, and Sisterhood all know that. Yeah. The space cocaine is purple. It's not white. but it's also really shitty CGI in this episode, because it just, like, shows up on her hand after It's not like it's a naturally like poured out, but you know, material from the actual vessel that they have.
And, oh, yeah, I completely missed that.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about it last week and everything. It's got to be Samuda, because there's a line at the end of the scene where Constantine says, "Another pinch and I'll be useless." And Shannon says, I wouldn't say useless.
Yeah, right.
That has to be Samuda at that point.
I'm going to ride on that theory. I doubt we'll get an actual like Samuda mention in the show, but maybe in passing.
Hey, would you like to buy some Samuda?
So after the steamy treehouse sex scene, it is back to Havoko and Natalia's room, and the Emperor is just freaking out.
Yep.
His last interaction with Desmond has really left him like rocked to his core, feels like. And he explains all this to Natalia, and he's like, he's pissed off that Kasha's not there, and he's, you know, it's going back and forth. He starts telling his wife a little bit more about the prisoner, Desmond. And this is when we get our Shai Hulud mention here.
Shai Hulud by name.
Yep. I thought that felt a little forced into the dialogue. Like, I'm sure they would know the name, but it just seemed a little forced.
I agree with that. Like, it's weird that everyone else refers to Shai Hulud as just like a worm or the worm or whatever. But
yeah,
I mean, I'm not knocking it because
me neither.
It's just, it's strange to hear someone not from Arrakis or on Arrakis say Shai Hulud, but
yeah, and more specifically someone not a Fremen refer to them as Shai Hulud.
Yeah.
But again, as you said, not mad at it at all. Yeah.
No. We love Shai Hulud.
Yep.
We also get mention from Havoko talking about Desmond, how he claims that Shai Hulud gave him a gift, some sort of power. I don't know. He's obviously insane, which seems to go very against everything else in Dune, because
it is.
Yes. Everything in Dune is always some kind of technology, no magic.
Well, and that is still an apprehension of mine, like for this series. Like, I hope that there is some kind of in-universe explanation that it's not Desmond has magic powers.
Hold on, let me go back on that. You could argue that the voice maybe has some magic quality to it, in a way that you're able to circumvent a subconscious, that we have an explanation for the quote unquote magic of the voice. We don't have any explanation for Desmond's magic here.
Yeah.
And I'm saying magic there with air quotes, right. You know, because we don't know what it is just yet. And I'm worried that we're not going to get an explanation.
Same here. You know, we're kind of going into that quote of, you know, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic or whatever.
Right.
And to this point, there's always been some kind of explanation for the things that could be considered magic. So, I really hope that they do get into that, because if they just leave it as magic, that's going to break the world in a little bit, in a little way, you know,
in a lot of way.
We'll call it a big way.
Cause even Ixion magic is just Ixion technology.
Yeah.
So
the Emperor's he's kind of leaning towards turning Desmond over, to the Richazes at this point, as like a peace offering. And, after Natalia gets a little bit of chance to think about it, she's like, oh, hell no, don't let this gift get away. You know, don't kill our friends to please our enemies.
Yeah. What a very like beautiful line there, honestly.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, and just to take a step out of this, like the writing in both of these episodes so far has been beautiful.
Yeah. I feel like that's also one of those very Frank Herbert kind of lines.
Yeah, agreed. We got to learn last episode that Natalia doesn't really like the sisterhood. Mm-hmm. She's not a fan of her husband's reliance on Kasha. She thinks that they're, you know, maybe not to the level that Desmond believes this, but I think she is in the same camp that they are, you know, manipulating him, or at least, you know, contributing to the perceived weakness of the Carino house.
Yeah.
So yeah, she just wants them to. Well, yeah, but you know, they're good about keeping the secrets. This is, you know, goes to show how, you know, perceptive that she is.
Yeah.
So yeah, she wants them to regain their strength, and she sees this as a gift, and they should use this. Which is diabolical. You know, I really did not see her like coming in hard on Desmond's side like this.
I thought it was very interesting because last episode we had that scene in the same room between Havoco and Natalia, where Natalia was lamenting the old relationship and Havoco's like, I have a different memory of it. Yet here he is counseling with his wife, who he seems to have, you know, fallen out of favor with and everything, and, you know, lost any feelings for. And I think he's only counseling with her because Kasha is nowhere to be found. You know, Havoco says, you know, Kasha didn't trust that soldier. Where was she when I needed her? So I think he's realizing like, oh shit, I guess there are other people I need to counsel with too.
So back with this, that scene ends and we are transported back to Wallach 9, where Tula is doing a little bit of gardening around the pool. She's looks like she's cutting up some moss that grows around that main central pool at the school.
That pool's in the shape of an eye, by the way, which I just thought was interesting, because last episode we have the vision of Inez in her red dress in the middle of an eye-shaped pool.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the same room that young Valia killed Dorotea.
Yep.
At the beginning of last episode. So that'll become, you know, more relevant as we go on. We don't stay there too long though. We cut back to the dorms where
Before we go, we do get some more whispering as Tula is gathering this moss and everything. So I don't know if that's just the show doing ambient noise or if there is some kind of presence of her own awoken memories as she's doing something so, what we will learn to be so dangerous.
Yeah.
Because this moss is used for something important here soon enough, but we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah. I initially took it as just like a diegetic music. But the in-universe explanation for the whispers being around, yeah, if I could see that, you know, if she's gone through the agony herself, then this plant would have a very special connection to her. So maybe it does. So after this, we're cut to the dorms, and Lila is sitting down next to Emmeline's, Sister Emmeline's bunk, and she just wants advice on, you know, if being a martyr is a good thing. And we know from the conversation earlier in the library that Emmeline is like a hardcore martyr stan. She fucking loves them. and we get to see why here now. And basically says that, you know, her family was in the battle with Raina Butler. And they knew they were going to die, but they, you know, still did their duty, became the martyrs themselves, and allowed them to win this battle.
That gave their lives to buy time for pulse atomics to be used at the end of the Battle of Corrin was her line specifically.
Yeah,
which, you know, when I first heard that line, I was thinking very much back to the end of Rogue One. Same kind of situation and everything. Martyrdom for a larger cause.
Yeah. And some of the part of the reassurance that Emmeline gives Lila, excuse me, is that, you know, when they die, they'll be reunited with their family.
Yep.
So talks of, you know, some form of an afterlife here. And that seems to, I don't know, seems to calm Lila down a lot. And, you know, kind of still, again, pushing her in the direction of, yes, do the agony.
Yeah. Human life is sacred. That's why there's no greater honor than to give it. That's why we shouldn't be afraid, because in death we'll be reunited with our four mothers. She specifically says four mothers. Reverend mothers believe more than anyone that the dead aren't gone. And she states that because the Reverend mothers have the memories of their dead foremothers.
Yep. And guess who's dropping some eaves in the corner? That would be old Jen, Sister Jen.
Good old Jen. She's not sister yet. She's still an acolyte.
Acolyte Jen, yes. So, yeah, just she's listening to the conversation that's happening between Emmeline and Lila does not look happy about it. She does not look like she's enjoying what she's hearing.
No. Not at all. But we don't linger there too long because we're back in... It's not the autopsy room, but it's a very similar like shape room where Kasha's body was and everything. Some kind of laboratory. And we see Tula preparing the Rossic poison.
It's the first mention of that name.
Yeah, so the Rossic poisoning is what Raquella is impacted with, and she ultimately through, you know, Prana Bindu skills and everything re-metabolizes the poison, and in doing so unlocks the memories, the genetic memories of the women that came before her.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a happy accident for her to do that and to go through that process and everything. And that is how the sisterhood begins, you know, filtering out who can be a Reverend Mother.
Yep. This is something that is very, very much in line with the histories as explained by the Dune Encyclopedia.
Yep.
And there's, so if you have a copy of that, you know, there's PDFs online of it, but even the Dune Wiki has a lot of, you know, a lot of entries from the encyclopedia in there. And yeah, it was something that was kind of found by accident by these, you know, the precursors. You know, they're part of the Zen Sunni migration, where it kind of all comes back to that. Mm-hmm. It is. If you've seen Dune Part Two, you've seen the better version of this. The water of life that is found on Arrakis is like a highly refined method of doing the same thing, but they don't have access to that at this point, I believe.
Nope.
This is, you know, they're still using the Rossic poison. It's like, it's a very dangerous, very dangerous process and a very dangerous poison going through, you know, that's involved in this agony. So, it's cool to see kind of when Tula was pouring that liquid over the moss, it turns blue into the bottom of the vial that she's got.
Yeah.
Which is really, really cool. So I was like, very familiar shade of blue.
Another Reverend Mother approaches Tula. We've seen this woman before, briefly in the last episode, and she's just kind of being coy, asking questions about the production of the Rossic poison and everything. And Tula's just like, oh yeah, this is, you know, just something I'm working on. And then she just immediately is like, yeah, and you can tell Valya that I'm doing what she asked me to do.
Yeah.
So she knows that Valya's got her own network of spies and everything, you know, watching, keeping an eye on Tula. And I guess, like we talked about, it's not that she doesn't trust Tula to run the school, but she doesn't trust Tula to do what she has to do to make sure that Lila undergoes the agony and unlocks these memories from Raquella.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Right before the scene ends, the woman that joins her, I believe it's, we don't get a name spoken for this character, but it is listed in IMDb. I believe it's Sister Avila. Avila?
A-V-I-L-A. I think, because I think we do hear the name. No, we heard Avila's name early on in the conversation between Valya and Tula. How Valya, Tula, Avila, and Kasha kept the secret of Dorothea's death.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. Cool. But she gives like a very ominous warning, I guess a really another warning, to Tula about what's at stake if they allow Lila to go through with the agony.
Yeah.
So another ominous warning there. And then we cut to space.
Yes. Motherfucking Highliner time, baby.
Yeah. And this one's a classic. It's like the classic car version of a Highliner.
Yeah.
It's not the round boba straw that we've come to learn and come to be, you know, really familiar with from the movies, but it is like an oblong or a rounded square.
It's a rounded rectangle, but then on the front, you've got that kind of like swooping, almost like shoehorn looking kind of shape to it and everything. Yeah. Big fan of this Highliner.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you. I think I like this Highliner more than the more refined one that we see in Denis Villeneuve's. Maybe it's just because it's new and this is my first time seeing it. But the shot of the Highliner with the single ship coming out of it, and then you have the two moons of Seleucia Secundus behind it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What a great shot. I love it. Anyone that's listened to the Dune Minute episodes knows that I love space just in general, but like all these space shots that we see are so fucking cool. So just big fan of all of that.
Yeah.
But it's cool to see, you know, the early implementations of Highliners by the Guild, because other than the one mention of the Guild by Lady Shannon earlier, knowing the importance of spice and, you know, who controls Arrakis and everything, we haven't had any mentioning of the Spacing Guild, I don't think, up to this point.
Not much at all.
So,
we talk a lot about the sense of scale in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Given that, you know, the size of the ship that is coming out of the Highliner and how, you know, how big it looks compared to the Highliner, I'm going to go out and say that this version of the Highliner is considerably smaller.
This is a tiny Highliner. Yeah. Because
the ones we get in the movies. So, I'm thinking about all those like egg ships that the Bene Gesserit and the Imperial court used in the first movie, how they were just like tiny little specks.
Well, the Atreides ships, you know, you had an entire fleet of these Atreides ships leaving the Highliner, and they were like single pixels on our screens as we're watching all of this and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is definitely a smaller than normal Highliner. But like I said, this seems to be early tech as they're, you know, figuring out everything.
Sure. And
getting it into place.
Right.
But to that extent, too, we also see the early implementations of ships by the Sisterhood. Because come, you know, Dune Part 1, they have the big egg shaped ship and they're, you know, moving around in very rounded, you know, vehicles and everything. Whereas here early on, it's basically a box with that wing that opens and, you know, retracts and everything. That's just another thing. Technology stagnates, but obviously like design choices and aesthetics change over time in this universe.
Sure.
Until Leto the Second is like, nah, fuck this stagnation. Let's go.
It's crazy to see the similarities. So as the ship is leaving the Highliner, we do see it fly in between what I'm assuming is the fleet that the Duke is referencing, circling the planet.
It is the fleet because it's the exact same ships that we see in the little model that we had in episode one.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you love consistency. You love to see it. So Valia and Theodosia are making their way through the spaceport. And she's giving like basically the marching orders to Theodosia, you know, get close to the princess. I've got to go deal with this, the Desmond stuff, or I guess she doesn't know Desmond yet, but you know, all the murder stuff that's going on.
Yep.
Theodosia's like, well, where's the Imperial people to meet us here? And she's like, nah, I didn't tell them we were coming. So we're keeping this a surprise. Which I thought was a very smart move on Valia's part. It really, you know, puts a lot of the power in her hands.
Yeah. if you arrive unannounced, they can't preemptively plan.
So where are they going? Well, we find out. Or at least we know where Valya's going. Yeah. So we cut back to the throne room, and man, is the Duke pissed. He's demanding that the prisoner be turned over to him, and says that Constantine let it slip, or his bastard son let it slip. And I don't think we've talked a whole lot about this yet, but Mark Strong is doing such a great job as the Emperor. I think he's playing this role really, really, really well.
His acting, first of all, just in general, is always fantastic. But yeah, he's really killing it with the role as Havoco in this series. I'm loving seeing him on screen.
Yeah,
he's just such a very like emotive person. Mm-hmm. Like his face is always telling a different story, or just adding to the story that's going on. I think we really saw that with the scene between Havoco and Natalia.
Yeah.
When he seems very lost in everything that's going on.
Yeah. And I love this little look that he gives Constantine when the Duke tells him that the son told his daughter about the prisoner. He just turns over and he's like, "You motherfucker.
How piece dare of you shit."
Constantine looks over at Lady Shannon, and she just gives him the most, you know, shit-eating grin and shrugs. This is really, really funny. Maybe the only laugh line that we're going to get in this episode. So the Duke is threatening to void the contracts if the prisoner's not handed over to him. And, you know, it's really heated, but we don't get to sit in the heat for too long, because right as he's, you know, shouting these threats, the doors burst open and Valya makes an unannounced appearance.
Knock, knock, motherfucker.
Yeah, she's to say everyone's shocked is to say the least. So they greet her, and she offers her condolences, and they kind of pick back up on their conversation, and she does her truth saying bit on Havoco as he's again telling the Duke that there's no one in suspect for the son, or there's no one in custody for the son's death. Mm-hmm. As they continue their talk, she does a little hand signal over to the Richesi truthsayer that's in the room with them and says, "You know, get these people out of here." So they quickly do that, and the Richesis make their exit. Constantine is sent away almost immediately after, so he doesn't hear anything else that he shouldn't hear.
Yep. Yeah, because clearly he's not trustworthy. Like any trust that he had is gone. So, yeah.
And Havoco starts asking about Kasha and where is she? And Valya has to be the bearer of bad news here, and says that she's dead. He looks really sad about this, you know, really sad, taken aback. She quickly moves past it to saying, "Hey, I want an audience with the suspect. You know, let me meet the guy." And he tries to lie to her in this moment, which is such a dumb thing to do.
Yeah. You're already caught once, motherfucker. Just don't even try it. But Natalia recognizes the importance of having Valya Harkonnen here. And she says, you know, it's not every day we're fortunate enough to have the Mother Superior as our personal truthsayer. And Havoco is just kind of like, yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
You know, it's brought up a little bit, but damn if Havoco isn't just like the most pushover, you know, emperor ever. Mm-hmm. For him to just be talked out of everything that he does.
Yeah. Well, I think he knows that. He feels that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, let's save that for to the end of the episode. Okay. I think that's, it's important to note that he understands that, you know, shortcoming that he's in right now. So we cut back over to Inez's room, and she's having a full blown panic attack about, or after hearing about Kasha's death.
And, Valya does a really cool thing here. You know, she directs Inez to remember her training and, you know, to calm herself using they don't say it, but to calm herself using Prana Bindu, she says mm-hmm. something to the extent of let your feelings flow to the end of your nerves.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get this, you know,
be audio aware effect, of everything.
This audio effect of, you know, her pulse slowing down, and, you know, we hear her breathing slow down, and we see her become more and more calm in this moment and everything. And I think that's in the show our first moment of seeing like true Prana Bindu and everything in effect. Won't be our last.
Yeah, I think you're right. Then she does like a, you know, after she's calmed down, she introduces Theodosia and Nez. And Nez's first question to Theodosia is, tell me what, or, you know, first demand, I should say, is tell me what happened to Kasha.
Yeah, I want you to tell me exactly how Kasha died. One other thing of note before we leave this, I think partially in a way to help calm Inez, but also partially in the truth of what Kasha saw in Inez, Valia says, you know, hey, just like Inez has told me a lot of great things about you and everything, and she foresaw you eventually one day becoming a Reverend Mother, and I don't disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
maybe it's a calming thing, but also maybe like the fact that Inez hasn't even stepped foot in the school, but has all of these trainings is a huge advantage for her.
Yeah. Yeah. I took that as a little bit of a further manipulation to get or to keep Inez on the side of the sisterhood, because clearly she wants to go there. But with all this, the rumblings of the sisterhood is like influencing the court and the emperor and all this kind of stuff, I took it as a, hey, just so you know, we still really like you. We still, you know, you're still on our side here about all this. So, not to say that it was disingenuous. It just probably had a little bit of an ulterior motive there.
Yep. And then we get to the interrogation.
Yeah.
Back in the suspensor cell.
Yeah. This is a really cool scene. First time Valia and Desmond are meeting. And man, what a cat and mouse game this is.
Dude, it's so good.
It seems like Valia has finally met her match, in terms of like, you know, intimidating people.
Mm-hmm. He's very stone-faced to the whole situation. He's not really, showing any emotion other than just the weird facial expressions that he has in general. I had to go back and watch it a couple times because it was hard to tell if he was feeling nervous or if it was just his weird mannerisms. And I'm in the camp that he knew he was getting under her skin and he wasn't nervous at all. He was just doing his weird shit that he does. Yeah. We get some background on him too. He's from a planet called Ballot. Which is, according to, you know, the Dune Wiki, just like a really shitty backwater planet that just got absolutely ravaged during the Butlerian Jihad, and, you know, ultimately became a organ harvesting planet. So not a great place to grow up.
Tough planet for a child indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she directly asked him, did you kill the boy? And he's like, yeah, I did. He was serving justice, I believe, is the line that he gives.
She asks, you admit to treason? And his response is, I admit to justice.
Yeah.
On whose authority did you pass that sentence? And he says nothing, and she looks at Habako, who has a really shitty poker face.
Yeah.
Habako's poker face is not that great.
Right.
And then she straight up asks, did you kill Reverend Mother Kasha? And his response was very interesting because he says, she was unworthy to stand beside the emperor. I saw the corruption in her heart the same way I see the blood trailing your every step.
Mm-hmm.
And that catches her attention because her immediate response, and she positions herself to his side and kind of gets closer to him. And says, see, how do you mean? And he says, Shai-Hulud took my eye and granted me the ability to see what you cannot. And we get a moment of each of their eyes like staring at each other. And we see Desmond's like kind of fucked up right eye and everything. And his pupil isn't exactly round. It's got a weird cut into it and everything. And we get some more detail on that. And she asks, who do you serve? And he says, the Imperium and only the Imperium. And then says a similar line to what Kasha said last episode. He speaks the truth as he believes it, but what he claims is a lie.
Yeah. And she's basically like, you know, pointing out, you know, he's admitting to being a murderer. She's calling, you know, for him to, you know, be dealt with accordingly. Mm-hmm. And Natalia and Haviko, I took it as one of three ways. They're either not convinced at all, they're unwilling to accept it, or they're willingly ignoring it.
Yeah.
I think I'm in the latter there.
Well, because he also kicks back immediately and mm-hmm. says, I saw your truthsayer for what she was. She undermines your instincts and chips away at your power until you have to grovel before lesser men, which, yeah, as we just talked about, is one of Haviko's biggest insecurities as an emperor, is that he is weak and he can't, you know, be the emperor that he needs to be. And he does falter mm-hmm. a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Bene Gesserit know that, and they're taking advantage of it mm-hmm. and weakening his control on the empire.
Yeah. Well, sisterhood at this point.
I'm so on autopilot at this point with talking about the Bene Gesserit after, fair. What, 8 months?
So they order Valya to silence, and this meeting is over.
Mm-hmm.
And we cut over to Valya, and we get another cone of silence. So we haven't seen this since the beginning part of the first movie.
The Harkonnens do be loving their cones of silence.
Yeah, they do, man. So Valya is basically like reprimanding the Duke's truthsayer, being like, you got to get this motherfucker in line, you know, keep him under control. I'm going to go deal with the Desmond situation. And you just get your house in order, please. And she mentions that she's going to meeting with the Duke later that night, but she's got to go meet with someone else on, I think the name was Zilic.
Yeah, no. So she has a contact somewhere in the capital of Seleucus Secundus, and she's going to go talk to that person.
Yeah.
Before, rather than going back to Wallach 9 for a very brief moment, I want to just stay on Seleucus Secundus here.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
And rightly so, because we are still staying in the, you know, Imperial Palace, because we get a shot of Kieran Atreides scanning vents.
Yep.
Everyone's favorite pastime. Kieran.
It took me a little bit. To figure out what exactly he was doing here.
Kieran moonlights as an HVAC repair tech, actually. So that's what's going on.
Scanning the rooms. He's definitely doing this in secret, because he gets really kind of startled by the voices that he hears is approaching, which is Haviko just laying into Constantine about his loose lips.
Yeah, no, I love having the subtitles on, because he is just tearing Constantine a new ass.
Yeah. And I'm so happy we get to go back to the club.
Yeah, everyone's favorite nightclub. Let's go. But we actually have a reason for a nightclub scene here. And like we do develop a reason for this club to exist.
Yeah.
And this club, as it is with most other sci-fi shows, and like I hate to like harp on this, but man, they're just really digging deep into all of these like sci-fi show tropes and stuff.
Sure.
It's
a hive of scum and villainy.
Yeah, it's a hive of scum and villainy. And in this case, it's a hive of rebels.
Yeah.
We get some backstory on, you know, some of the rebel activity in the Imperium. And it's, you know, being coordinated and managed out of this nightclub and everything. Mm-hmm. Turns out Kieran Atreides maybe doesn't like the Imperium that much.
Just when we thought he was going to be a goody two shoes yes man to the Emperor, he is part of the rebellion.
Yep.
And yeah, the people they're talking to are kind of the higher up, like coordinators. It seems like in the rebellion, and one of the people there is the bartender from the last episode. And
who I now believe is actually Fremen. Just being addicted to spice, like we talked about the possibility of last episode.
Yeah, I think that's a strong theory. They're talking about, you know, maybe now is the time to, you know, do their big blow against the house, you know, the Carino family. Kieran doesn't seem too on board with the idea at first, but I think he wins him over eventually.
Well, he doesn't seem on board just because he knows that the palace is already on high alert.
And they have a lot of like grief and sympathy on their side right now. So doing anything else to them would probably help them more than hurt them.
Yeah. But he says, you know, at the end of it all, he's pledged his sword and his name to this rebellion because the great houses are hoarding spice and turning the people to violence just to get what they need to survive. So clearly, you know, he needs to just do what he thinks is best and turn against the Imperium here.
Yeah. Yep.
Turns out.
Well, real quick, something I forgot to say here.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the scene, we see them, you know, handing over the spoils of the raid on Arrakis. Mm-hmm. And I believe this is our first glimpse of actual like Solaris and like the currency in the show.
We didn't even get any glimpses of Solaris during Dune Part 1 or 2 either. So
no. So they're not called that by name, but if they're still using the same currency 10,000 years later, then yeah, this is our first look at Solaris. Kind of square looking things, square looking pieces of metal.
Typical sci-fi currency. Yeah. The bartender gives Kieran a little, hey, by the way, I don't really trust you still because I saw the whole thing with the princess, so I'm watching you, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it turns out the bartender, she's a sister. She is Sister Michaela, Valia's contact in the capital city.
Yeah. Just playing the field like they love to do.
Yep. Yep. The sisterhood, they do be manipulating. You know, Kasha was an idol to her. Like I talked about at the beginning of the episode, you know, Kasha was very beloved by everyone and, you know, looked upon with a lot of favor. And because of Kasha's death, Michaela's more than ready to, you know, accelerate plans that are in place and everything.
Yeah.
You know, she talks about the push and pull that the sisterhood has over the Imperium and over the rebellions used to keep the Imperium in check and everything. And, you know, Valia asks Michaela for all the names of everyone associated with the Arrakis heist because they need to burn the cell.
Yeah. And she's using that as a leverage to get, you know, back in good graces with the Emperor, you know, give him something very worthwhile. And, you know, it'll make the sisterhood look good again for him because there's a lot of doubt in his mind right now.
Yeah. And we're setting up for some future drama between Habako and Kieran Atreides because he's named by Michaela.
Yeah.
So
and I love that look that Valia gives, like, she's like Atreides, and the Michaela's like, oh, is that going to be a problem? And she's just like, oh no, not a problem at all.
which seems finally. Very counterintuitive to the, we don't want to build loyalties to families, but build loyalties to the sisterhood thing. Because she also has the goal, the expressed goal from the beginning of the first episode of bringing on, not to be cliche about it, but bringing honor back to the Harkonnen name after everything that happened in the jihad.
You know, I felt like this was like some very deep seated hate of the Atreides, something that you don't just outgrow. Like she's done a good job of like maybe not bringing it up every time she talks about them. But, you know, she finally has a chance to really, you know, twist that knife a little bit. And she's like, she's pleased about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from here, we go back to the training room with a brief scene. And it's some more sparring between Kieran and the princess. So the princess should have been gone at this point, I believe, back or to the sisterhood. Cause the night that Kieran and her went to the club, that was one of their last nights together.
Yep.
So she's just pissed. She's showing off her, some new knife skills and blowing off steam. Does not want to talk about what's going on at all. So they get into a sparring scene, and I guess eventually she opens up and tells a kind of harrowing story about how she was abducted by a previous rebellion. Mm-hmm. And Kieran was like, I've never heard of this.
Well, and the story, ultimately, the purpose of her telling that story is telling the audience more about how Habako is a weak and, you know, terrible emperor, and he doesn't really have any power or anything. We get some kissy time, but, you know, just kidding. She's actually been holding a knife to Kieran's belly and says that they can't do that anymore. I would like to say real quick before we move on here, because we do need to go back to Wallach 9 because there have been some smaller developments. But before we do that, we get a much better representation of the shield deflecting blades that are not slow, I think.
Yeah,
here.
I agree.
It was a much better scene, you know, showing, especially when she was like going ham on the test dummy and she was like trying to stab it, and we're just seeing the shield like deflect the knife and everything. I really loved seeing that. So any shade I had towards last week's episode in the sparring scene, I feel better about that this time around.
Yeah, I agree. This was well done here.
Yeah.
Last thing on Seleucus Secundus before we head back over to Wallach 9 is a meeting between Natalia and Desmond in the suspensor chamber. There's some very like veiled questions back and forth. She's making it seem like she's going to give him up to the Richesis. But then at the very last minute says, you know, your powers are a gift. So I feel like we should use it.
Maybe we should use this gift rather than it being taken away.
Yeah, exactly. So, in so many words, telling him to go, you know, he needs to use the powers on the Duke.
Yeah. And then let's go halfway across the universe to Wallach 9.
Yeah, let's do it.
So we had some other scenes back and forth. So at this point, you know, we're sitting with Lila and Jen. Last we had seen Jen and Lila, Jen was over or was trying to drop some eaves.
Yeah.
And you know, Lila is trying to justify her going through the agony, but then Jen is reminding her that, you know, it's sisterhood above all, not sisters. And you know, it's hard to have a mission when you're dead, even if Lila believes in the sisterhood and the sisterhood's mission as a whole. Yeah. So it's Jen just saying like, hey, I still wouldn't trust them.
know, she's like, they're playing you. They're using you as a tool. They don't actually care about you. Why can't you see this?
Yeah.
And the next scene that we get with Lila is her talking with Tula on kind of like a balcony and talking about the mothers and the ancestors.
Balconies in this show.
I love a balcony, man. Absolutely love a good balcony. They start talking about, you know, ancestors, and Lila asked about her mother, and Tula says, your mom's dead. And
your mom's fucking dead, kid.
She's dead. She's dead. Get over it. She's dead. But all this does is make Lila go, oh, that means I have a chance to see her if I do the agony. And Tula's like, it doesn't quite work like that. But sure, if you want to think about it that way, maybe. Go for it.
Maybe she'll be there. I don't know. Can't promise it.
Yeah. Just another like manipulation tactic to get her to willingly choose to do this.
Yeah, but this definitely seems to be what solidifies that decision then for Lila.
Yeah,
because the next time we're on Wallach 9, Lila is just in a white shawl, standing what looks like is an operating table. Tula and I forget the name of the other older Reverend Mother are standing there with her as well.
Avila.
Yeah, that's right. Are standing with her as well. And each of the acolytes seem to like be saying something to Lila, and Jen just kind of turns away from her.
Yeah.
And we're getting some exposition.
Good luck and goodbyes.
Yeah. We're getting some exposition from Tula while all of this is happening about the history of Raquella's Rossic poisoning and how Raquella used early techniques to metabolize the poison and unlock this genetic memory. We get Lila's full name, Lila Cho Grace Naberto Anirul. It is time to awaken those who made you. It is an agony, but only this once. When you find yourself in the darkness, seek the light. Your foremothers will awaken wild and hungry. Do not let them sway you. All that matters is the light. It will lead you back to life, back to us, and you will emerge a Reverend Mother. 10,000 years later, nothing changes because we see an abbreviated version of all of this with Jessica.
Yeah.
but we're talking about this now. So we talked about it a little bit during the opening credit sequence, how we saw that, you know, kind of blue long vial thing. And that is the vial that holds the Rossic poison. Lila is laid out on the table. Tula gives Lila some like last words of like, hey, just follow my voice. Just breathe. We'll make it through this. And then she just releases her finger from the end of it to let a drop go into Tula or go into Lila's eye, and just immediately just she's screaming, she's in pain. And what I thought was really cool was that we got the same, well, maybe not the exact same, but very similar like visuals that we got when Jessica took the water of life, of like that very thick blue liquid just kind of moving through Lila's blood and her brain cells and everything, and just really kicking into it. And then through that, you know, kind of liquid sequence that we get with the really cool practical effects, it almost looks like they took like two different colored liquids and like mushed them between plexiglass and then just like pressed around on it.
It's a lot of blue liquid fighting red liquid.
Yeah.
that we're seeing on screen.
Suck it, blues.
Tula's talking her through it. She's you know, talking her through this, you know, break it apart into its atoms and or its molecules. And this seems to calm Lila down. And after she's calmed down, I guess we think she's through the worst of it. But we would be wrong.
Yeah, because we find her waking up in like a dark catacomb tomb kind of situation.
Yeah, yeah. It almost reminded me of like the Hall of the Minds of Moria from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. Very similar vibes.
So it was a very creepy place, and we get a little bit of a jump scare here. Some figures start to scurry behind, and we hear whispers, and before too long, Lila is surrounded by all these, you know, shades, I'm going to call them. And presumably her ancestors. But they're surrounding her. They're circling around, trying to reach out and touch her, and she's freaking out at this point. And it looks like she like faints almost, like into their arms.
She loses control and faints, and then it looks like they just begin consuming her.
Yeah, yeah, that's it's
really fucking freaky and weird. And then she wakes again and finds a very decomposed Raquella standing above her, looking down on her.
Yeah.
And then back out in the physical world, Raquella begins speaking through Lila, which
is cool.
I thought this was really cool because we had Lila's voice and Raquella's voice overlaid on top of each other while this is happening. And she says, "The key to the reckoning is born twice, once in blood, once in spice. A revenant full of scars, a weapon born of war on a path too short." Tula asks, "What is the nature of their power? How do we fight it?" And then the response is, "We walk together hand in hand with only one light to guide us. Our steps are short. We do not falter. We know what we will be born into the infinite."
Yeah.
Which so, is, I got some
spitting bars.
Yeah. I got some possible theories on this. Okay. I don't know how deep you want to get into that. It's one of three people. It's either Paul, Leto II, or Desmond.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like that's a fairly easy jump to get to. Those are the three main, like, and/ protagonist of the stories that we have.
And/ pro is the correct way to describe them.
Yeah.
But what I'm worried about is that maybe you and I jumped the gun a little too heavy on going directly into Leto II in the first episode, and that they're really just trying to contain this only to Desmond. Which could is be. Disappointing.
We don't know. We don't know yet.
But
I still think there's a strong case that those eyes that we see in the visions are Leto's, because that's, you know, that's where he lives pretty much, is in prescience.
Yeah.
And he looks forward and backwards in time. So, you know, it's not out of the question, but, you know, that's something that we're going to have to, we'll see as the story goes down.
Yeah.
Or goes on. But like with any prophecy,
mm-hmm.
It's vague enough to where it can be applied in many different situations.
Yep.
So, you know, yes, we may have jumped the gun a little bit, but we only had a little bit of information. So, well, you know, we'll TBD on where that lands.
The Paul thing was just, you know, because obviously it's Paul Atreides, right? He is the Kwisatz Haderach. But I saw a very interesting theory that Desmond was maybe a unintentional Kwisatz Haderach that didn't exactly go the way that he should have gone.
Could have been.
And this is, you know, maybe what we see of a unplanned, unprepared for Kwisatz Haderach.
You know, we know that spice and, you know, the specifically the water of life is it really involved in creating the Reverend Mothers and the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yep.
During the sandworm attack, you know, it could be shown to that, you know, he got a massive dose of this, or he somehow came in contact with the water of life, you know, through his attack and on Arrakis. So maybe that is the case. Yeah.
Don't know. We'll have to see.
Yep.
But unfortunately for Lila, this is kind of where her time inside this catacomb, I don't want to call it a vision, because technically
it's the other vision,
whatever we'll call it. Her time ends because knock knock, Dorothea opens the door and shows up instead, and Tula says, well, to Lila first says, "My little lamb, is that what they told you?" They being Tula saying, "Hey, maybe you'll see your mother."
Yeah.
To get you to come here. "I'm sorry, granddaughter, she's not here, but I've been waiting for you." And then Tula says, "Harkonnen, you stole my future. Now I'm taking your hope." And then Lila is just consumed by all of the women in this vision.
Yeah.
And then in the real world, drops the tooth that Tula gives her.
Yeah.
Or gave her when she was only just a baby.
Yeah. So I'm sticking to classic HBO series logic.
Uh-huh.
We do not see a physical death here.
Yep. So she's not.
So it is
dead for sure.
It's not. She's not dead for sure. But at the very best, it ain't looking good for Lila. So TBD on this until we see a burial. then I'm not fully convinced that she's dead.
No. But she's, even if she makes it through, she's probably not going to be doing too hot.
No, not at all. All right. So second to last scene in the show is back in the throne room, and Duke Richese's back on his bullshit, threatening to pull the forces unless the prisoner is handed over to him.
And what do Duke's you know? The prisoner is there.
Yeah, well, and he's not even making like veiled threats anymore. These are just like naked, open threats about killing the emperor. So it's like it's very, very, very bold of him to do this. And Desmond walks in and just shushes the Duke and starts to, you know, do the same thing he did to the son, starts to burn him.
Yep.
He goes down. He's in agony. He's begging for mercy. And the emperor calls it off and basically says, OK, that's what the fuck's up right now. So you need to, you know, calm yourself and leave and don't tell anyone about this. And we'll let it, you know, fade into history or something like that.
Well, basically, we'll let bygones be bygones at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting to know that Desmond can, it doesn't have to go all the way to kill someone with it. He can, you know, administer this burning in doses. That's an interesting development.
Yep.
But really what I wanted to call out in this scene is that right here at the very end, the emperor feels like he seems like he's got his confidence back. You know, he's got, you know, some swagger in his step.
He's got his mojo back.
Yeah. Right.
They took the mojo out of the frozen Austin Powers and gave it to Havoco.
Yeah. Yeah. And all it took was Desmond burning a couple people. So yeah, he seems to, you know, he seems to be back, you know, to his presumably old confident self. And yeah, we cut from here and back into that hollow room with the cool table where we get probably my favorite scene of the show here. And I that would make sense that they, you know, they make this the very end scene. Desmond and Valya meet back up, and Desmond
don't meet back up. He intercepts her as she's coming back into the palace because she thinks she's going in there all high and mighty, going to go let Havoco know what's up and everything.
Right.
What's interesting, too, is, you know, as she's walking into the palace and everything, we're hearing some of the whispering and everything. And I went back and listened probably like 10 times with like the maximum volume from my computer in my ears and everything to like make sure I was getting this right. But here are a couple interesting things. The voices say, can't imagine the consequences. You know what had to be done. You belong to another world. Something, something, how you see it. So like the voices are becoming more prominent to Valya, which I thought was interesting. Does it mean anything? Probably not, but it was just there and I noticed it.
Yeah.
You know what I also noticed? A motherfucking glow globe, baby.
Yes, sir. We're two for two per episode.
We are two for two. If we go six for six, this show immediately gets a 10 out of 10 for me. I love glow globes.
We get granddaddy glow globe here. He's the oblong shape. Yeah. I noticed that immediately.
Yeah. I've also noticed that the glow globe seems to follow Desmond around.
Oh, yeah. He probably says, so, you know, come on, follow me.
Maybe it's his pet. I don't know.
Who does?
I want a pet glow globe. But yeah, Desmond does intercept Valya as she's trying to make her way into the palace and ultimately is just like, yeah, your services aren't needed anymore. You're not allowed here. Get the fuck out.
Yeah. And, you know, after there's a little bit of back and forth about, you know, each of them trying to big dog the other one here.
You think you can replace me? I'm the shit.
Yeah, pretty much. And Valya hits him with the voice. So we're also two for two with the voice and tries to pull the same stuff she pulled on Dorothea in the beginning of the first episode. And it almost works. The knife gets up to his throat and he resists at that last second, which, you know, honestly goes a little bit into that theory of maybe Desmond has some Kwisatz Haderach abilities, because I believe that's something that, you know, Paul said, Paul has a certain level of resistance in the second movie to the voice.
Yeah. Well, it's all about his willpower at that point.
Yeah.
And like, clearly he has some shit going on and everything where he's able to overcome even this subconscious subterfuge and everything. And he kind of laughs at her and is like, yeah, nice try.
And then we get a really chilling last line of the show. And he's looking at Valya and says, I've figured out what your fear is. You know, it's not that no one will hear you. It's that they'll hear you and just won't care.
And then she just leaves.
Yep. She's like, I got to get the fuck out of here. This is not good.
Yeah.
And then we roll credits right then. Mm-hmm.
Quick recap, though. I really liked this episode.
Yeah.
I texted you after I watched it, and I just said, good episode. I'm feeling still a little like cautious and everything because there's still a lot of room to fuck up. But yeah. I'm feeling a lot better this week than I did at the end of last week. Especially after the first watch, after multiple watches, definitely feeling a lot better because the show is not taking its time. It's moving stuff along. We're not having any filler anywhere. My biggest criticism is still the whiplash of back and forth between different planets and everything. And hopefully as the story begins to coalesce, maybe we'll have less of that, but it's not likely. Yeah. I mean, if I had to give it Shai Halutz, I'd say maybe 7. I thought it was really cool to see everything that we had going on, especially with a failed agony. I think that was one of the things last week that I was hoping that I said that I was hoping that we would see at some point is either more spice agony or a failed agony. And, you know, we saw successful spice agony with Jessica in part 2, but to see a failed one and actually what is going on inside the mind of a person who is undergoing the agony, that was really, really cool. Yeah.
Big really cool stuff. Yeah. I was going to go in the 7-8 range myself, because, you know, we got introduced to a lot more new stuff here, which is just, I mean, I love world building. That's anything that you can do to, you know, expand the universe, in a consistent manner, is great. So yeah, I'm very pleased about this. And I think we've answered some questions. We've asked a lot more new questions, but the show is doing a good job of not keeping us in a lot of suspense for too terribly long. But still maintaining the air of mystery throughout the whole story. So I'm pleased with it.
I'm just glad that they're really sticking to a lot of established Frank canon too, you know?
Yeah.
Like I talked about with the slow blade penetrating the shield and how we see, you know, the shields really deflecting blows that they should be deflecting and stuff. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of the really cool stuff with the early exploration of the Spacing Guild and everything. Like, put that directly into my veins, please.
Yeah, it's really good world building. I'm a fan of it. All right, man. Well, that's let's call episode 2 officially reviewed, and I'm a fan.
Thoroughly reviewed.
Yeah, for sure. I'm gonna hop into the edit bay and get this thing chopped and sliced and put out as soon as I can. So let's do this all again next week.
As always, you can find us online in other places. On Instagram, we are at the Dune Minute. On Blue Sky, we are at Dune Minute. And you can email duneminute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us. As I said at the top, to all of our new community members and listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this journey. We've been having a lot of fun with it, even though, you know, it might be a little more stressful for Zach with all the editing. But hey, at least there's only 4 more episodes.
Right.
So we'll catch you next week for more of the Dune Minute and or the Dune Minute for Prophecy. And, you know, catch you tomorrow for more episodes of the regular Dune Minute for part 1. And see you every weekday until we're done with that movie.
That's right. All right, cool. See ya.
See ya.